The film industry has deepened the ties that China is forging around the world, and we're exploring China's entertainment industry and its grip on Hollywood on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. For the second year in a row, China retained its status of being the biggest box office market in the world. Total movie ticket revenue in 2021 topped $7 billion. That's tracking by Asia's film industry consulting firm Artisan Gateway. And in the words of Eric Schwartzel, Hollywood reporter for The Wall Street Journal, it's a market too big to ignore and too lucrative to anger. Have you seen a movie that's been censored by the Chinese government? Where do you think Hollywood should draw the line in adding so-called Chinese elements to films in hopes of them getting approved to screen in China? 800-642-1234. Eric Schwartzel's debut book is called Red Carpet, Hollywood, China, and the Global Battle for Cultural Supremacy. Eric, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here.
Well, good morning. With the games, Winter Games underway in Beijing, you know, when you talked about the 2008 Summer Games in Beijing, you called it China's coming out party on the global stage and signaled how seriously China was taking its ambitions about entertainment. Where are we now as you look at Beijing in these games?
It's a fascinating bookend to those 2008 games. I mean, really, in just 14 years, we've seen China's image on the world stage change markedly. And you're right, those 2008 games in retrospect really do feel like a coming out party, because they really updated in the minds of, I think, a lot of Americans and people around the world, the image they had of China. You know, for throughout the 70s and much of the 80s and 90s, China seemed like the dark side of the moon. It was a country that, you know, is still coming out of the Cultural Revolution and the Great Famine. And then we saw China in 2008 at the Olympics, really, in the words of one person I spoke to who was there, pounding its chest and saying, we are here, we are going to be a global superpower. And now here we are in 2022, and I think China finds itself more on the defensive. Its superpower status is not questioned, that's for sure. But it has waded into human rights issues and political issues that countries are ignoring less and less, whether it comes to doing business with them or even just traveling there for the games.
And the film industry has been feeling perhaps they've been there almost all along. One curious thing, too, Steven Spielberg had been tapped in 08 to consult on the opening theatrics of those games. And Spielberg then became navigating some really dicey geopolitical issues in that moment. What happened to Disney in that framework, and what Disney wanted to do in China?
Well, so in 2008, Steven Spielberg was hired as a consultant for the opening ceremony. He was going to work with a Chinese director by the name of Zhang Yimou, who is really just critically and commercially adored by Chinese audiences and audiences around the world. And Spielberg and also the Taiwanese director Ang Lee were hired to help out with making this opening games as spectacular as possible. And Spielberg announces his involvement. He had gone to China, I think, once or twice to start his duties when Mia Farrow and her son Ronan Farrow published a series of op-eds in the Wall Street Journal criticizing Spielberg's involvement because of China's support for efforts in the Sudan. And they even went so far as to say, does Steven Spielberg want to be remembered as the Leni Riefenstahl of the 2008 Summer Games? And it really is an amazing kind of precursor, prequel to what we're seeing now with diplomatic boycotts and athletes who have to juggle going to China and participating in the games, but also having to answer for what might be taken as a tacit endorsement of Chinese policies. And Spielberg was the most famous Hollywood player in 2008 to be wrapped up in that cross current. But what's fascinating is that several years later, around 2016, 2017, he would be back in business with China, because by then the Chinese box office had grown so large, it was inevitably going to be number one in the world, that his company, Amblin, when it was reconstituted with new financing, set aside a stake that would go to a Chinese partner. And so Alibaba, which is considered, you know, China's answer to Amazon, is an investor in Spielberg's production company today and helps get Steven Spielberg movies onto Chinese screens.
Eric Schwartzel with us, reporter at the Wall Street Journal, author of the new book, Red Carpet. You can join in. What do you think about China and the movies? Have you seen a movie that has been censored by the Chinese government? 800-642-1234. I'm wondering if you can kind of walk us through what it means for a film studio to try to get a movie into China and what that process is like to craft it and then get it approved, get a green light.
It's quite a process, and it remains, even years into this, quite opaque. But basically, let's say you are a studio with a new Jurassic Park movie and it costs $250 million to make and another $100 million to market worldwide. That is a price tag that is going to all but require release in China, because you're going to need those box office receipts. And so first things first, you make the movie and avoid any representation or comments that might anger Chinese officials, right? So in the new Jurassic Park movie, we're not going to see a Chinese villain revealed as the evil dinosaur scientist at the end. So that's the first thing at the script stage. But then once the movie's completed, you have to send it over as a file to China's Ministry of Propaganda, where it is screened for a group of Chinese censors. And these censors, a lot of times they're state bureaucrats who have shuffled around the party system. Other times they're film studies professors or longtime party members. And they'll watch the movie not only for, you know, cosmetic issues, let's say, like, you know, is there a scene set in China that makes the city look dirty or underdeveloped? Those are kind of cosmetic things, but it also might screen for thematic issues, right? Is there a message in this movie that Chinese officials look askance at? And if the movie is okay, which by now most of these summer blockbusters, which are rather innocuous and know what to avoid to get into China, they're usually made with these approvals in mind. The movie will be accepted as a Chinese release and then be released in Chinese theaters, much like it would be here in the US. The only difference is that studios have no control over the decision. And if a movie is rejected, there's no memo released saying, here's why. So over time, Hollywood studios have had to look and see what gets in and what doesn't get in to try and divine some system or pattern that they can discern to know what movies will get in and what won't. And then really, frankly, Kate, like getting into China can mean the difference between profit and loss on some of these bigger movies, especially as the box office has grown over the past decade.
Hugely grown.
At a time, it's important to note that the American box office has been relatively stagnant. So growth in US box office sales has come largely through inflation or rising ticket prices. Whereas in China, it's come because of a surge in the number of theaters being built and a culture of movie going really taking root. And so it's not uncommon today for a major Hollywood release to gross hundreds of millions of dollars in China and send 25% of those sales, so 25 cents on every dollar, back to the studios as, frankly, pure profit.
It's just amazing to me, too, what the lengths that the studio will go to get that movie in. And it's not just slicing and dicing or replacing, you know, a shot here and a shot there. But, you know, Top Gun, you talk about Maverick and erasing the flags of Taiwan and Japan. I mean, just give us a sense of what Hollywood will do to make it less political for China.
Right. I mean, I think at this point, because there have been so many high profile blunders, as you said, or what I guess the studios would consider blunders, like erasing the Taiwanese flag from Tom Cruise's jacket in Top Gun, just as a precaution, really. I mean, no Chinese official was telling them to do that. They were self-censoring at that point. But you're absolutely right. The lengths to which they will go to try and get into China is quite extreme. If, you know, for a while, the studios would bend over backwards to appeal to China. So there was a few years there, and it still continues to some degree today, where every major movie seemed to have a random Chinese actress in it, or a random scene that took place in China. And today, you know, whenever a movie comes out, there might be some quick snips they can make, whether it's, you know, this movie's a little too violent for the Chinese audience, so we can maybe take out a couple shots that are particularly R-rated. But certainly, I think baked into the system today is just there are some certain third rail topics, especially with regards to things like Tibet, you know, certainly the Tiananmen Square or elements of Chinese history that the party has tried to erase and scrub from history. Those are topics that are just not going to be touched by studios that need to do business in China, because they know even if those movies don't get into China, they may be punished in their larger business elsewhere.
Wall Street Journal film industry and business reporter Eric Schwartzel giving us a sense of how dependent Hollywood has become on China, the largest theatrical market in the world. What role should American films have in promoting American values and free expression? How concerned are you about censorship and propaganda creep, if you will, into films? Is Hollywood's heyday behind us? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Eric Schwartzel here on the Ideas Network. The number of cinema screens in China now tops 80,000. That's from a report citing official data published in China Daily last October. We're tracing the rise of the cinematic industry in China, its relationship to Hollywood, and what it bodes for the future of free expression on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Thanks for being here. Wall Street Journal Hollywood reporter Eric Schwartzel describes his book as a pair of X-ray goggles on the most powerful American art form of the last century. What should America do to fight the growth of China's, quote, soft power? Do you think Hollywood will only grow further reliant on international markets to turn a profit? 800-642-1234. The book is called Red Carpet, and Eric Schwartzel is with us for the hour. I want to look at the contract that U.S. studios were forging with China. And there was this 13% agreement that became known as the master contract. What did that entail and what did that mean?
This is back in 1994. And it's important to remember that in the early 90s, as China was opening up to the world and its economy was trying to forge deeper ties with the West, there were similar deals struck, you know, from companies as far flung as Boeing to semiconductors, trying to tap this small but clearly growing market. And Hollywood was no exception. And so Warner Brothers thought we might be able to get movies into China, really, for the first time since Mao's revolution. And so they drew up this contract. The first movie that was let into China under this contract was Harrison Ford's The Fugitive. Mm-hmm. And the studios said, we will release this film and you can send us 13% of ticket sales, which really is minuscule. I mean, the average foreign market sends about 40% of ticket sales back to studios. And in the US, they receive about 60% from American theaters. So 13% is really just a rounding error at this point. But at the time, the concern was less about making money in the market and more about combating piracy. Because on every street corner in China, it was possible to get illegal copies of these Hollywood movies. And the studios back then were more concerned about sort of changing that consumer behavior than making millions of dollars from box office sales. So The Fugitive comes in 1994, and several movies follow, like Broken Arrow, True Lies, big 1990s blockbusters. And the Chinese audiences go crazy for them. I mean, there was stories of you know, the famous scene in The Fugitive where Harrison Ford jumps out of that, what is it, a dam, a waterfall,
right.
You know, something, and apparently audiences bursting into applause and going to see it several times. And for many, many years, that master contract that was drawn up for The Fugitive was the one that was used for every movie let into China. And for a long time, it was really only 10. And so until 1999, I'd say, when Titanic really blew the lid off what an American movie could do in China, the studios thought, you know, it was a nice thing to do, but they weren't going to dedicate a whole lot of their time to it.
What happened to Milan? You know, the strategy around Milan and eventually being allowed into China after, you know, ending the country's boycott of Disney. What was the tension there? Because, you know, especially around that story.
Right, right. So in 1997, so just 3 years after American movies are streaming into China to begin with, Disney made a film about a young Dalai Lama called Kundan. It was directed by Martin Scorsese. And this movie angered Chinese officials because it was, first of all, it valorized someone that they consider something of a state enemy, and also recounted in harsh detail Mao's treatment of the Dalai Lama and the Tibetans. Now, Disney, whenever they were making this movie, was not thinking that this would jeopardize their business in China, because, as I said, no one was really thinking about movie business in China to begin with. But yet, nonetheless, Chinese officials, when they discovered that Kundan was being made, signaled to Disney that essentially this was not going to be an issue with just this movie. It was going to become a contaminant in the larger corporate structure that would jeopardize plans to sell Disney toys in the country, plans to maybe eventually build a theme park in the country. I mean, so this is a movie that might have only cost
China wanted so badly.
China really in the mid-90s wanted a Disney theme park, because there's really no greater validation of where China has gotten itself to than a Disney theme park on the mainland. I mean, what a symbol of a new China. Disney didn't want to move that quickly. They didn't think the market was quite ready for a Disney theme park. You know, there's a reason there's only, what, like 5 or 6 in the world. They don't just build them when someone asks for one. Yet nonetheless, they knew it was a possibility, and it would be billions of dollars of investment and revenue that was jeopardized by a Dalai Lama film that was not going to be released in China, and frankly, probably only cost, you know, $20, $25 million to make. But yet nonetheless, Disney was banned in the country after releasing the film. The then CEO, Michael Eisner, had to fly over to China about a year later and apologize. In fact, there's this remarkable transcript of his meeting with a Chinese official in which he says, you know, the bad news is that we made the movie. The good news is that hardly anyone saw it. And he pledges to never insult his Chinese friends with such a film again. And soon thereafter, Mulan, the original animated version of the Chinese story, was allowed into the country's theaters. But what was interesting even back then was there was, I think, some Chinese enthusiasm for this high-profile treatment of their story. But for a long time, Hollywood thought that making movies about Chinese stories would be the ultimate holy grail, right? It'd be the ultimate way to win over Chinese audiences, when really, if you think about it, the logic doesn't quite follow. Like, would we really expect American audiences to go see a Chinese version of Davy Crockett?
No.
There's, you know, and so I think for a while, Hollywood tried to make Chinese stories, when, especially as China's film industry grew more and more sophisticated, Chinese audiences thought, we'll go see our own filmmakers making these stories. You do what you do well. You don't need to do our stories in a B manner.
And Chinese citizens even, you called it, they felt like they were being soy sauced. That, I think that was the quote.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, they really started to see through the pandering quite quickly. I mean, so around 2013, 2014, we're at this moment where the Chinese box office is just growing at a clip, and every producer in town is reading scripts and saying, you know, hey, you know, can this girl be Chinese?
How
can we work in China? Exactly. And so these Chinese actresses are flown over and cast in these bit roles, and it's really a bait and switch. What they'll do is they'll shoot a scene or two. Often they don't even really have any dialogue, and oftentimes if they didn't speak English well enough, they'd have to learn their lines phonetically. And so they would shoot a scene or two, and then lo and behold, when they released the movie in China, all the marketing and advertising had those Chinese stars in it. So they would maybe try and lure Chinese fans to the movie, thinking, oh, I'm going to see Fan Bingbing or Li Bingbing. And then they'd get there and Fan Bingbing is in for 2 seconds and that's it. So they started to refer to those actresses as flower vases because they just saw them as these kind of decorative additions. And it really, Kate, I mean, it really got pretty absurd very fast. I mean, there's this Transformers movie I write about in the book about that really just bent over backwards to appeal to the Chinese market to the point of putting in a bunch of product placement. And there's a scene where Mark Wahlberg raids a convenience store in Chicago, and somehow this convenience store is carrying Chinese protein powder.
We have Wall Street Journal film industry reporter Eric Schwartzel helping us understand the complex and tenuous relationship between Hollywood and China's rising entertainment industry. Are you worried about producer and screenwriter decisions to alter a film to make it more pro-China? What might that mean for American values and for free expression? What questions do you have about China's historical large investments in American movie theaters and where they're at today? We'll talk about that. 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Eric Schwartzel after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're discussing Hollywood exporting itself to China and the geopolitical and economic consequences on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The classic Hollywood apology, journalist Eric Schwartzel writes, as we've been talking about, is saying sorry if an offense was caused by the action without apologizing for the action itself. And that has really kept some Hollywood execs in China's good graces. Director Chloe Zhao was blacklisted for comments she made years before she won Best Director Oscar last year for Nomadland. And she spoke with NPR about Eternals, her first Marvel's film. China didn't come up, but the creative process did, and that blended into her reflections on feeling like an outsider.
I never want to be put in a box because I think we live in a conformist society because it feels comfortable to put people in boxes. And as a creative, especially, I feel like I will die if I stay in a box.
Should American actors and directors, producers, speak out about human rights abuses and risk not getting hired on future projects? 800-642-1234. The book is Red Carpet, and Eric Schwartzel is with us for the hour. Eric, you hear Chloe Zhao there talking, and I'm just wondering, how did she, you know, she was referred to as the pride of the country, but then was ultimately censored, blacklisted. What happened?
Right. We've seen this more and more. Chloe Zhao, who, as you said, really became at one point the most acclaimed Chinese director in the U.S. whenever she was the clear frontrunner to win Best Director for Nomadland. I mean, these comments you referenced she made in a relatively obscure magazine in 2012 were discovered and spread throughout Chinese social media. And I think one important context to understand is that in China, there are some really vocal nationalist groups on these social media sites that will often seek out and then amplify any criticism of China that they find. And this is, it's especially sensitive to Chinese citizens who have left the country. And so when these comments that, as I said, at this point were a decade old, spread around of Chloe Zhao saying that growing up in China was growing up in a country with lies everywhere, eventually her, her presence and the entire Oscar campaign was scrubbed from the Chinese internet. And what's fascinating is, you know, here we have an example of the daughter of a Chinese industrialist born in China, educated in the West, working in the West, and really succeeding in the West, still having to play by Beijing rules. And there's something of a playbook here because I think, you know, a lot of people might hear these stories and think that China's falling prey to the Streisand effect, you know, where if they had not made such a fuss, the comments were read and seen by more people because of the fuss that Chinese officials made than if they just sort of let it go. However, this seems to be something that dates back to China's overall sort of opening up to the world, which is there's a dialectic that roughly translates to kill the chicken to scare the monkeys. And we see this time and time again with American businesses that cross some line that angers Chinese officials, where a very public, very loud example is made of it. And it essentially teaches all observers a lesson. And if the infraction seems minor, all the better, because it tells everyone else, like, really lower your bar for what you're willing to risk. And that's why every, you know, it seems like every few months or so, we have an American company changing maps on its website, or an actor like John Cena apologizing in Mandarin for implying that Taiwan is its own country.
I just want to hear just a little bit of him apologizing.
你好，中国，这是江西呢。我必须说，身在在速度与激情中，我做很多采访，很多很多很多。
So he's saying there, "Hello, China. I'm John Cena. I have to say right now in Fast and Furious 9, I have many, many interviews." And he goes on for over a minute, just trying to state his case and apologizing profusely.
Right. I mean, really, frankly, it looks like a hostage video. I mean,
it does.
He's saying, you know, I'm sorry that in this interview, I made a comment that implies Taiwan is its own country, which is a, you know, which is challenged by Chinese authorities who view it and Hong Kong as part of this kind of one China. And what's fascinating about this is really that stray comment jeopardized quite a bit. As he references in that clip, he has this new movie, a Fast and Furious movie, coming out in China. Its release would be jeopardized. The company releasing that film is Universal, which is part of NBC Universal, which is part of Comcast. So lots of holdings that could suddenly be thrown into disarray. I mean, it's worth noting that it is Comcast right now airing the Beijing Winter Olympics. Mm-hmm. You quickly see how these comments start to fester and spread and potentially infect an entire corporate holding. And so, and what's fascinating is I was talking to someone recently who was explaining how by now, after seeing many stars like John Cena, Angelina Jolie have to issue these apologies, now when American stars go to China or have Chinese media tours, they are given these thick binders of bullet points on what topics to avoid, what topics are okay, and if certain topics come up, how to answer them.
Wow. Eric Schwartzel with us, reporter at the Wall Street Journal, author of Red Carpet, Hollywood, China, and the Global Battle for Cultural Supremacy. You can join in with your thoughts. Do you think Hollywood will go further and further reliant on international markets? What do you see happening in China? What questions do you have about the technology transfer of movies to China? 800-642-1234. I just want to talk about the financing, the funny money that flowed into the U.S. by Chinese billionaires in somewhat recent years. And it made me think differently after reading about it, Eric, about the seat that I'm sitting in an AMC theater that is a big plush recliner seat, perhaps made possible by this outside money. How has China propped up, in particular, theaters in the U.S.?
Yes, certainly that seat is made possible by Chinese money. So in 2012, a Chinese real estate conglomerate called Dalian Wanda Group, which had really risen to become a dominant real estate firm in China through the growth of shopping malls that were servicing the middle class that was growing over there, it made a roughly $2.6 billion acquisition of AMC Theaters, which at the time was the second largest exhibitor in the U.S., headquartered in a suburb of Kansas City. Mm-hmm. You know, as American as a business as they come, came in and acquired the company and said, "We are going to invest in this company. We're going to take it public," which was going to provide a lot of cash. And at the time, the AMC executives were experimenting with this kind of refurbishing of theatrical auditoriums, where they were going to take out 2/3 of the seats and replace them with these luxury recliners that they thought would differentiate the experience from staying at home and allow them to charge more. And it's proven to be quite a success. And a lot of chains have replicated this strategy. And that's why you see a lot of these theaters that seat fewer people, but do so in nicer chairs. And it was made possible by this Chinese financing. And what's fascinating is at the time, there were concerns about a Chinese acquisition of a company like this. You know, I think the American movie has always, throughout the last century or so, been seen as an arm of the American government or a way to extol the American way. This certainly was the case in World War II and during the Cold War. The American movie was seen as kind of this soft power tool. And so there were some politicians who were worried that a Chinese ownership of an American theater might allow the Chinese company to do things like screen Chinese propaganda movies in American cities and infiltrate the country that way. And it really was quickly dismissed because the CEO of AMC pointed out, rightfully, I think, that that would be very bad for business because you're not going to sell many tickets to a Chinese propaganda movie in Tallahassee.
Well, wait, you might sell some Gawker tickets, just, you know.
Fair enough. Yeah. That's true. But I don't know if it's going to beat Spider-Man.
No.
But I think, that conversation would be very different if that acquisition were happening today, just because of the relationship between the two countries. But it really set off a wave of Chinese financing that actually moved from the theater into production. So there was a moment where it felt like every production company from large to small had a for sale sign outside because these Chinese billionaires were coming over and trying to cut deals. And there were a few things going into that trend. One was the government in China had signaled that they wanted to expand their cultural industries. And so that's a bit of a signal to Chinese business executives that these are the kind of deals we'd like to see you make. You know, if you can make a deal and sort of signal that it is doing its part for a government initiative, it'll probably flow a little bit more easily when it comes to approvals and things like that. And so that's why you saw Wanda, the company that owned AMC, buying Legendary Entertainment, which is a production company that has financed Jurassic Park movies and Pacific Rim was a movie that it made. And then there were smaller firms that were really rushing to cut deals. However, as quickly as that money flowed into Hollywood, it stopped just as quickly.
It evaporated because
the Chinese officials started to grow quite skeptical because there were deals being done that made very little business sense. My favorite example is there was a Chinese copper processing firm that was trying to buy Voltage Pictures, which was at the time best known for releasing Dallas Buyers Club. Mm. You know, this is like a very small operation here that a Chinese copper processing firm wants to own. I mean, where's the synergy there? And really what it was revealed to be about was an effort to get Chinese money out of the country and into stronger currencies. And this was something that the Chinese officials feared because they didn't want it to weaken confidence in the Chinese economy. So they announced that they were going to start scrutinizing such deals more closely. And that essentially turned off the spigot.
That cult, yeah. You know, one Chinese investor told you once he invested in movies so they could integrate self-driving cars that his company was making into the movies. I mean, what on earth? There's a lot easier way to get product placement.
I absolutely agree. I mean, that was one of the more memorable interviews I had. Yeah, whenever he said that he was, you know, one arm of his company was developing self-driving cars, so he would need a production company that could make entertainment you could watch in those cars. And it might not come as a surprise that the company's not doing so hot today. Didn't quite end up working out as he predicted.
Wall Street Journal film industry and business reporter Eric Schwartzel, our guide to how financially dependent Hollywood has become on China, the largest theatrical market in the world. Have you seen a movie that's been censored by the Chinese government? Perhaps a James Bond movie Skyfall or the remake of Red Dawn? Have you wondered about a subtle message in a film or ways Chinese actors have been depicted in Hollywood scripts? Still time, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Eric Schwartzel here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. I was reading the epilogue of Eric Schwartzel's debut book, Red Carpet, the other night, and I looked up from my perch on the sofa to see one of my kids browsing selections of Nick Jr. on demand. And for a partial episode, they settled on Blue's Clues and You. And I looked up over my reading glasses at the grinning face of Joshua De La Cruz, the show's first Asian American host. And I felt that twinge of, should I Google Nick Jr. in China just out of curiosity about what might come up? What are Nickelodeon's exports to the Middle Kingdom? How have they worked out? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Wall Street Journal Hollywood reporter Eric Schwartzel with us for about 9 more minutes. Eric, you have some concerns about the amount of children's programming coming out of the film pipeline in China. What can you tell us there?
It's a really fascinating development. I think I spoke to a guy I got to know and befriend when I was working on this book, who recently had traveled back to see his family in a more rural part of China. And he was telling me, you know, I think he was in his mid-30s. And when he was growing up, whenever he would watch TV, one of his favorite shows was Transformers. It was a cartoon back then. And it was one of the few Western, or I'd say foreign, shows let into the country. And that was his favorite thing watching growing up. And he went home and he saw these young kids watching TV, and they were watching cartoons, but they were mostly cartoons about the, you know, the glories of the People's Liberation Army, or movies about victories in war in Chinese history. And he thought to himself, you know, this is a very different media diet than I had as a kid. And what will these children think about China's place in the world as they grow up? What kind of ideas will we see, because there is such a strain of nationalist entertainment being piped in, not just for children, I'd say, but just for Chinese audiences across the country? I mean, I think there's this irony that over the past decade, Hollywood has learned to strip Chinese villains from its movies, while at the same time, China has cast America as the villain time and time again. And if you look at the Chinese box office today, the most popular films are often state-backed propaganda movies that are about the Korean War, and oftentimes about American lapses in the Korean War. I mean, I've also even met American actors who make a living in China playing American soldiers. You know, they just have to keep dying on screen, and they have quite a good career.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me, too, of Rennie Harlan and some of these other directors who have made inroads in China and making a career out of making movies there.
No, that's right. I mean, that was one of my favorite experiences writing this book, was going over and seeing Rennie. And Rennie, I think a lot of listeners might know some of his biggest movies from the 80s and 90s, which were things like Cliffhanger, Die Hard 2. I mean, we're talking big popcorn entertainment. And then in the 90s, he made a pirate movie called Cutthroat Island that is really only remembered for being one of the biggest bombs in Hollywood history. And it really torpedoed his career. He, as he said to me once, you know, he couldn't like show his face at the popular lunch spots here in LA. But then, lo and behold, about 20 years after that, his agent got a call that there was a movie, a Jackie Chan movie in China that wanted an American director. And so he took the job and he went over and he made a serviceable action movie, just as he had done at the height of his career in the US. And since then, he has been on China's A-list. And it works out really quite brilliantly, because the kinds of movies he made in the 80s and 90s have kind of fallen out of fashion in the U.S., uh-huh. You know, the bigger schlocky blockbusters.
Yes.
But Chinese audiences are still relatively new to those kinds of films. So they really take to them. And they also are looking for guidance on how to make them. So he's sort of functioning as a one-man technology transfer, because he will show them how to cut these movies a certain way to really amp up the drama, or insert a little bit of humor to give it a little bit of levity. And I really have to say, I've rarely interviewed someone who seemed more in his element than this guy who still doesn't really speak Chinese, operating these film sets where he can show up and run the show.
And there's this whole idea that I think comes out in your reporting and in the book, that, you know, once China learns that skill, or once that technology transfer of movie making is fully ingrained in China, like, they don't need Hollywood anymore. What is that about, or where are we at with that?
Yeah, there was this concurrent phenomenon happening while Hollywood was bending over backwards to access the Chinese market. China's own film industry was growing more and more sophisticated and growing out beyond, I think 20 or 30 years ago, it really was just all about churning out rather medicinal propaganda movies. Whereas today, we're seeing movies that frankly remind me of 1990s Hollywood, right? Like where you have comedies, you have domestic dramas, you have zany detective movies like Beverly Hills Cop or movies. There was even a remake of Brewster's Millions that was released in China and made hundreds of millions of dollars. Chinese audiences, as I said at the top of the hour, they want to see Chinese stories on screen, and Chinese filmmakers are growing more and more sophisticated at delivering that. And as they have, tastes have shifted. Whereas before, Chinese authorities had to worry about Chinese movies accounting for a majority of the box office every year to save face. Now they don't at all because it seems like audience tastes have gravitated toward the Chinese movies. And the Hollywood films, when they do get in, are becoming more and more of a novelty rather than a preferred option.
I want to land on just the icy relations. Like one tweet can jeopardize years of building business for the NBA in China. And I'm thinking of the tweet that was erased, "Fight for freedom, stand with Hong Kong." What is at stake here for these American companies trying to do business in China?
Well, until something changes between the two countries, I think this is going to be the course of doing business, where it is a market that, especially for publicly traded companies, is still so lucrative that you can't shut off access to it. And yet it seems like every company from Intel to Tesla to H&M to Apple is learning that that will require playing ball. And so far, and like I said, this could change if political pressure increases, but so far, companies and studios here in Hollywood have made the calculation that those concessions are still worth it. And that if there is an errant tweet or a comment made, that cleaning it up rather than ignoring it or trying to take a stand is still the way to go.
We only have a few seconds left, but what special measures do you take as a journalist when covering China? What about protecting your sources and getting the information you learn out?
Yeah, I think it's really top of mind. And what I would do is when I would travel to China, I would make sure to send all of my notes to myself before I went over with my laptop. And then before I would leave, I would email the entire file to my poor boyfriend, who would have it sort of on hand before I went to the airport. And then it's also just a matter of, as you said, just being very sensitive about when I'm talking to people, making sure that, as one person once put it, we speak in code, because there are times where you might bring something up on a telephone call and the call mysteriously drops. And it can get in your head sometimes, but I think it's also just important to know it's a concern, address the concern, but keep trying to get the information out.
Eric, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Eric Schwartzel, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Red Carpet is the book. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.